I need to idealize other people. In fact, to be emotionally healthy, I need other people I can admire, people whom I can experience as wise, courageous, stable, reliable, and calm. Throughout my life, I experience a recurring need for people whom I can use as models or as mentors. This has become a source of the values that guide me. One of the people I have idealized is Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. I've read the major biographies of his life. I've listened to his voice. I've watched his face in old recordings. Along with millions of others, I admire his preaching skill, his courage, his commitment to nonviolence. So each year, at this time of his birthday, I recall the stories about his life. King was called to serve his first church in the summer of 1954 when he was completing his doctoral dissertation. The church he was called to was Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, located on the downtown square in Montgomery, Alabama, across from the state capitol building. The congregation of 300 was educated, middle class, liberal, and all black. They called King in hope that he would be less controversial than their previous minister, the Reverend Vernon Johns. Now, Reverend Johns had shocked his congregation and shocked the community by replacing the small sign in front of the church, and now this is the state capitol square, the small sign in front of the church with a much bigger one, which he used to announce his sermon topics. He was called to the police station to explain himself when he announced the sermon on the sign as segregation after death. He told the police that he did believe there would be segregation after death because all the whites who supported segregation in this life were going to hell. The Klan burned a cross in front of the church in reaction to the announced sermon topic on the sign, "It's Safe to Murder Negroes in Montgomery." Reverend Johns got in trouble with the congregation because of his ad libs from the pulpit. One Sunday, heads turned to watch as Dr. Trinholm, the president of Alabama State College, the largest employer of Montgomery blacks in general and of the Dexter Baptist Church members in particular, Dr. Trinholm, the president of the college, arrived late and eased himself into a pew. Reverend Vernon Johns said from the pulpit, "I want to pause here in the service until Dr. Trinholm can get himself seated here on his semi-annual visit to the church." Dr. Trinholm never returned to Dexter Avenue Church while Johns was the minister. The congregation hoped that Reverend King, being only 25 years old and serving his first church, would be more willing to take direction and advice from the church board. And during the first 15 months of King's ministry, he got to know the people in the congregation. He preached on Sundays. He reorganized the administration and expanded the programming of the church. And he became friends with Ralph Abernathy, the young minister at First Baptist in Montgomery. Abernathy and King would talk about the differences in their churches. And Abernathy explained the difference between First Baptist and Dexter Avenue this way. At First Baptist, you may talk about Jesus. At Dexter Baptist, with all those university professors, they would prefer that you talk about Plato or Socrates or somebody like that. And if you have to mention Jesus, they would like you to do it just as quietly and as briefly as possible. As you can see, Dexter Avenue Baptist was similar to our own humanist congregation here in Sarasota. These first 15 months of his ministry, getting to know the church and the community, these months were the most serene and uncomplicated of Dr. King's adult life. The serenity ended in December of 1955 with King's election as president of the Montgomery Improvement Association. The evening of Monday, December 5th, 1955, the 26-year-old minister, who had been called by his congregation and hoped that he would not be controversial, spoke to 5,000 people about the Montgomery bus boycott. Most of the people were outside the building in the streets because the congregation did not hold 5,000. His words about the boycott showed his deep commitment to the dignity of every person. He said, "No one must be intimidated to keep them from riding the buses. Our method must be persuasion, not coercion. We will only say to people, let your conscience be your guide. Our actions must be guided by the deepest principles of the Christian faith. Once again, we must hear the words of Jesus, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, pray for them that despise you. If we fail to do this, our protest will end up as a meaningless drama on the stage of history, and its memory will be shrouded in the ugly garments of shame. But if you protest courageously, and yet with dignity and Christian love, future historians will say, there lived a great people, black people, who injected new meaning, new dignity into the veins of civilization." Well, within weeks, the boycott tested Dr. King's courage and his belief in nonviolence. The night of January 30th, 1956, in the middle of a speech to a mass meeting, he received word that his home had been bombed while his wife and baby girl were inside. He left the speaker's platform and went home immediately. At the house, he found that his wife and child were all right. Around his home was a crowd of angry blacks. He said this, "I want you to go home and put down your weapons. We cannot solve this problem through retaliatory violence. We must meet violence with nonviolence. Remember the words of Jesus, he who lives by the sword will perish by the sword. Remember, if I am stopped, this movement will not stop because God is with this movement. Go home with this glowing faith and this radiant assurance." Now, these are some of the finest moments in the history of American religion. Moments that speak of the dignity of all people and call on us to show courage, love, and nonviolence. Dr. King was a man of extraordinary courage and commitment to nonviolence, whom I idealize as one of my models. I was 17 years old the evening of April 4th, 1968, when I heard the news that someone had shot and killed the 39-year-old Dr. King. The next day at my high school, no one mentioned the killing of Dr. King until my last class of the day. My American history teacher was a white man born in Mississippi who had studied to be a Methodist minister. He had spent a summer living in Harlem, had been arrested once in a civil rights demonstration, and had been in Washington for the 1963 Civil Rights March. He spent the entire hour of the class talking to us about the importance of Dr. King. He said that Dr. King's preaching was so powerful that day in Washington in 1963 that the hundreds of thousands of people in the crowd would have followed him anywhere, would have done anything he asked. In the days that followed the death of Dr. King in 1968, our nation experienced terrible race riots. This was a dark time in our country's history. 15 years after his death, Congress created the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. However, in 1983, our national leaders still had mixed feelings about Dr. King. As President Reagan reluctantly signed the law, he said that he guessed we would never know for sure if King had been a communist. Of course, Dr. King was never a communist. 43 years after his death, in October of 2011, President Obama dedicated the King Memorial on our National Mall, the only national memorial to a member of the clergy on our mall. Last September, the National Museum of African American History and Culture was opened on our National Mall. The museum is so popular, it is necessary to apply for entrance passes 4 months in advance. Today, I believe that Dr. King's words can help in guiding my own life. Just as some people approach ethical dilemmas asking, "What would Jesus do?" Sometimes when I'm struggling with a problem, I ask myself, "What would Dr. King do?" For answers, I look again at the speeches and writings of Dr. King. I use the best of his life as a guide in my own life. I especially admire his courage. In my own ministry, occasionally, angry people verbally attack me. It goes with the job of being a Unitarian Universalist minister. But no one has ever bombed my home. No one has ever tried to injure or kill my family. If my home was bombed, I don't know whether I could say the words that Dr. King said that night back in 1956. Imagine standing in front of your fire-bombed home and saying to your supporters, "I want you to go home and put down your weapons. We cannot solve this problem through retaliatory violence. We must meet violence with nonviolence. Remember the words of Jesus, he who lives by the sword will perish by the sword." Dr. King was a human being who taught us about justice. He gave us a dream of a better, more caring society. And that dream stays with us today, many years after his death. And it still guides us. So every year at the time of his birth, I celebrate that dream. This year, more than most years, I need his model of ministry. His courage and his commitment to nonviolence I need more than ever. I say thank you to a man who gave his life for the principles of justice and freedom.